Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now are Rick Nagel, the managing partner at Acorn Growth Companies, and former NASA administrator Jim Bridenstine, who has just joined the company as a senior advisor to shape technology, aerospace, and defense investment strategies. Jim headed the Aeronautics and Space Agency until January 20th and also served in Congress as an Oklahoma Republican. He is also a former naval aviator who flew the E-2 Hawkeye, later transitioning to the F-18 Hornet, where he was also a key part of the team at Strike over at Fallon. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us. Administrator Bridenstine, honor to have you on. And Rick, always a pleasure.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Rick, congratulations. Jim, congratulations. You weren't on the job market long, so kudos for that, and also for a job well done. As I prepared for this, a bunch of folks in a very bipartisan manner gave you hearty congratulations on a job well done. Rick, start us off. What's Jim's job as you start sort of the fifth iteration of your aerospace and defense fund?
Well, Jim's going to help us map out what we hope to be a winning strategy for the deployment of our new fund, which we expect will continue to track with the way we put it to work, capital work in the past, one third aerospace, one third defense, one third intelligence. But space will have a potential theme running through all three of those potential verticals, and we're going to try to make sure we smartly navigate the myriad of opportunities right now that are presenting themselves.
And Jim, you're bringing such a breadth to the job. What are the most interesting trends that are going to be shaping these markets that are in turn going to be shaping how you advise Rick and his team? Or I should say, actually, right, your team at this point as well.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. First of all, it's an honor to be able to join a company like Acorn, which has been around for a long time, and it has done really great work on behalf of its investors. And I'll tell you what excites me most is that Acorn is a private equity firm that is making investments in the United States of America. I think the companies in the Acorn portfolio are critically important for the nation. And the fact that Acorn is headquartered in Oklahoma, my home state, really made this a great fit for my family. And I look forward to all the great things we can do together. I'll tell you, when we think about the future of aerospace, it's changing very, very rapidly. The way the government does contracting has been changing very, very rapidly. You know, it used to be that if the government got involved in something, it would purchase, own, and operate hardware and deliver hardware to warfighters. And in today's era, a lot of things are being done as a service. And we've seen that at NASA when you think about how we do launch to the International Space Station or how we're going to land on the moon. The government is very interested in using these, other transactional authorities where the government buys services from a provider rather than being the owner and operator of the systems. And I think that's a trend that is going to continue. And as it continues, I'm looking forward to working with Rick to help identify opportunities where we can make good decisions on behalf of our investors.
Rick, it is an extraordinary period, right? I mean, as Jim mentioned, we have this service mindset that's been very important to try to get as much value as money, right, for the government to carry a little bit less cost in what, it's more about what the delivery of the service is as opposed to owning the infrastructure for it. The defense outlook has been strong and supported. The commercial aerospace market has been absolutely crushed, obviously, because of the coronavirus pandemic, whereas space is looking good and intelligence is looking good as well. And there are folks who think that, as we try to combat domestic extremism, that's going to be another bit of a growth opportunity there. Where do you see all of these markets growing? What's your outlook when you look at aerospace, at defense, at space, at intelligence, for example?
Well, I think you summed it up pretty succinctly. So maybe to build on that, I think, you know, commercial aerospace is going to track with, you know, the public confidences, you know, we all have relative to getting back on airplanes again and flying around. Countries opening up so that when you know, for example, fly someplace, you get off the plane and actually be the tourist you intended to be. That's going to drive traffic, and in turn, that's going to drive the order book for new airplanes, and that in turn is going to drive the supply chain that supports the, you know, the OEM production. And so, I think it's going to be, you know, it's going to be tough sledding for a while, and those that are in the, you know, the manufacturing segment of that, kind of the tier three suppliers, working their way up to the integrators are all going to continue, I think, to struggle for a while. But I do think that that hope is on the way. The vaccines obviously are working, and as more and more people are inoculated from the coronavirus and are in a position to start flying again, I'm hopeful that it'll spring back faster than others think that it will. But I still think we're going to be, you know, dealing with this for a while. On the defense aero side, and by the way, that's new production. On the MRO side, that probably springs back a little faster than the production side. So, you know, clearly we're continuing to eye opportunities on the MRO side of things. As it relates to the defense market, particularly defense aero, I think all indications are things will be kind of steady as she goes. You know, you got new platforms coming online. You got some being retired. It's all fairly predictable. I don't think the new administration coming in, you'll see big changes in any of that one way or another. You know, maybe there's always, you know, an argument to be made that maybe you'll see a reduced ops tempo, which will drive maybe a little less need for, you know, maintenance, repair, and overhaul and modernization upgrade programs. I guess we'll see. But typically, MRO in defense aero holds up pretty well in administrations like this, and so we'll continue to track all of that on defense kind of other, which is big for, you know, and that mm-hmm. covers lots of things. You know, I don't necessarily see our troop levels rising necessarily under a Biden administration. I mean, if you're looking to kind of bring down defense spending, the first thing they typically cut is force structure. So I think you'll see some things in those areas over time, but even with a 50-50, you know, Senate, and a bunch of defense, you know, hawks in there, I think, with Biden, you kind of know what you're going to get. You have 47 years of public service, and my sense is he'll trade domestic programming for defense programs, and that you'll probably see kind of much the same there. I mean, you know, we'll watch it as it unfolds, but with a House majority for the Dems that's slim, in a near tie in the Senate, obviously, I think that we'll continue to see strong defense posture coming out of Congress. On the intel side, again, I think it's kind of the same thing. I think to some degree, it's kind of status quo. We're not going to suddenly break out in some global, hey, we trust everybody kind of posture. So I think you have to continue to keep your intelligence safe and watch our adversaries. Certainly tensions already with China are starting to rise a bit. They're starting to test the Biden administration some already. I think that puts pressure on our intelligence community to keep an ever vigilant eye abroad. And then there's just areas that we're behind, whether it be hypersonics, AI, autonomy. Those areas are going to need significant ongoing investment. And so I think, you know, that again will be that the United States will maintain its positioning to try to catch up and get ahead. As it relates to space, and certainly Administrator Bridenstine is the authority on this. You know, there's the commercialization of space, which captures the hearts and minds and returning to the moon and going to Mars and all the things that, you know, he's been championing. But at the same time, it's the critical infrastructure in the defense of that we all depend on every day and take for granted, don't think about, whether it be financial transactions or getting from, you know, point A to point B on our maps or even communicating with one another. Very easily disrupted, and the technology out there to do that exists. So the need to defend our space assets and put ourselves in a position where we can, where our quality of life and the freedom we depend on is not compromised by somebody wishing us ill will, is something we're going to need to focus on as well. So, obviously there's NASA, there's Space Force, all the agencies, you know, have some space related, strategy and programming. So our job here will be to try to navigate that and figure out how we can best partner to, with the United States and our allies to make sure we maintain our edge.
Let me, Jim, I want to come to you in a second, but let me just follow up on one thing, Rick. I mean, do you, you know, if there is some form of domestic extremism campaign, I've talked to folks on markets, some think that it could be kind of a growth area. Others say, you know, not all that much money, rather redirection of existing capability. I mean, obviously, Jim, you can probably better talk about this by far than I could in terms of what legislative changes would be necessary. But do you see that as being sort of a growth thing, whether on domestic cyber, on information, disinformation, businesses and the like that that might be attractive at a moment like this?
Well, first of all, I just say I hope not. I mean, you know, it's unfortunate that we're even having that kind of a conversation. But I think you know it's hard to say. I mean, this might be a moment in time where there's just a lot of discord. So in terms of it being a sustainable investment thesis, right. I think it's just hard. It's too early to tell.
Jim, let me get your sense on some of this, including, you know, you did spend many years in Congress. I should also point out you're still a major in the Oklahoma Air National Guard at the end of your Navy service, right? So they can't keep you away from the flying mission.
When I came to NASA, the NASA law, the law that created NASA in 1958 says that the NASA administrator shall have no outside employment. And so I had to give up my gig as an officer in the Oklahoma National Guard. So,
oh, wow. I'm very sorry about that.
Yeah, I was too, but it's okay. I was happy to do it, to serve my country as the NASA administrator.
Any chance you're going to go back to doing that? Just parenthetically?
I probably not. I'm 45 years old at this point, and I'm moving on. So I love the Oklahoma National Guard, love the Navy, but I think it's time for me to move on.
Let me take us back to the conversation about what you think the spending outlook is going to look like, right? I mean, you sat in Congress. You know, I think Rick is right? Biden's got a lot of history. There is a lot of bipartisan consensus in terms of the importance of defense spending. But folks are also saying, look, it's going to come under pressure and it's going to flatten, which can be effectively a bit of a real-time cut. Where do you see spending going? Because, you know, not to sound too cynical, but, you know, as a tendency, each party behaves differently, whether they're in power or not. If Republicans are in power, they tend to worry less about deficit spending. The minute a Democrat gets elected, all of a sudden it becomes a priority. You know, where do we end up going on this, both politically, but as well as, you know, in real term spending, do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to change much, to be honest. And I'll tell you why, because when you look at the appropriations process, you know, what you'll find is you'll find the administration put forward a budget request. And in that budget request, there may be, you know, cuts in defense. We don't know yet, but that's a possibility based on previous administrations. But that being said, then that budget request goes to the House and to the Senate, and they actually start marking it up, and you know, the defense appropriation bill will have to get through both the House and the Senate. It won't match. Will they be able to get a conference that does match? Undetermined. Historically, it's been difficult. But in the end, what always ends up happening is nobody passes a defense budget until they can get all of their other domestic priorities put in the bill. And that's why you end up with these omnibus spending packages, and everybody comes to the table and largely nothing changes. And because they roll all 12 appropriation bills into one massive omnibus spending package, that's what puts our country on the brink of a government shutdown every year. And what we've seen now, I think, is a strong desire by both parties to avoid the government shutdown. So I'll be honest, given the way the system works these days and the way it's been working for over a decade at this point, I really don't see very many changes in the amount of budget that is put forward for defense.
Let me, Jim, take you to your career at NASA. You were the 13th administrator. And NASA is one of those agencies that does very much like any successful government organization, right? Is always building on its predecessor. You know, I remember the commercialization of space ideas that floated when Sean O'Keefe was administrator and talked to him about it. And then it went to Mike Griffin and from, you know, Charlie Bolden, and it went to you. Each one of you have been built, you know, building on that, which gets you, for example, to Crew Dragon, for example, which was a tremendous accomplishment. And kudos to you and the whole team for really buoying the nation right at sort of the height of the pandemic and a stressful summer. What would you say were some of the things you were most proud of achieving during your tenure? So,
without question, it's got to be launching American astronauts on American rockets from American soil for the first time since the retirement of the space shuttles back in 2011. So we went almost 10 years without a human spaceflight program. And during that time, of course, we were spending money with Russia to go to the International Space Station. And it was time, and I'll be honest, I really think the relationship as it relates to civil space exploration with Russia is important. It's a tool of diplomacy for our country, but it needs to be a no exchange of funds partnership, where we can fly on their rockets and they can fly on our rockets. But when it becomes a dependency where the price just continues to go up and up and up, It gets to the point where we needed to have our own capability, which we do now, and we need to continue the partnership as we move forward. But launching American astronauts, I think, was the biggest thing that happened during my tenure. Building the Artemis program to return to the moon and take the first woman to the moon, and I'll tell you the most important thing is the fact that that we built it in an apolitical bipartisan consensus. When we have members of the House and members of the Senate on both sides of the aisle promoting and advancing the Artemis program to return to the moon sustainably, to live and work for on another world for long periods of time so that we can go to Mars, I mean, that's the continuity of purpose that you have to have. And that's why Commercial Crew was successful. You mentioned, you know, going back to Sean O'Keefe, and then Michael Griffin, and then Charlie Bolden. You know, the success that I enjoyed at NASA was because of the hard work of those people that came before me. And it's important that we recognize that when we do have that continuity of purpose, we can do really impressive things. It's when we get cast to and fro when administrations change, that's where we lose billions of dollars and a lot of capability for our country. And I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful, given the people that I've heard may take over NASA as administrator. I'm very hopeful that we're going to have that continuity of purpose. All the names that I've heard are very qualified and very capable people.
That's very, very encouraging. One of the other things that's encouraging as a space fanatic who really was motivated to do what I was doing. I mean, it was the Cold War, but also remembering the moon landings as, you know, my dad allowed us to stay home if there was a moon mission because he thought, look, this is incredible history, certainly one of the most extraordinary achievements in human history. President Biden is a giant space fan, right? Not only does he wear an Omega Speedmaster for everybody who knows as the moon watch, he's actually got an Apollo 17 moon rock now in the Oval Office. What are the policies you hope and you expect the incoming administration to embrace when the president himself seems to hold the entire notion of space exploration in high esteem?
Yeah, so I think, again, the continuity of purpose is that's got to be, you know, the true north is to keep the continuity. And that was true when I came in. I hope it's true when the next administration comes in. But I would also say, when we think about the Artemis program, the SLS rocket and the Orion crew capsule, the European service module, these are major programs that are on the, they're literally on the 1 yard line. All we've got to do is punch it into the end zone. And so we need to keep those going, but we also need to build this human landing system. We have not had a human landing system since 1972. And that's a big undertaking, but an important undertaking, and we need to do it commercially. It needs to be something where NASA is buying services, not owning and operating the hardware. Although we should be very involved in the development of it, from an engineering perspective, just because it's going to be American astronauts that are riding on it. But I do think that, keeping the program moving forward is critically important.
Did you at any point when you were in NASA be absolutely stunned in marvel at what we achieved the first time around, right? Because replicating it has been so hard. Yeah. And yet we did the F1 engine, we did the lunar module, we did deep space tracking, right? Yeah. Would you ever marvel that you were sitting here in 2017, 18, 19, 20, and these guys managed to do this in the 1960s with slide rules and room full of computers?
Yeah. So the problem, Vago, is not the technology. The problem is the political will. We go back to the 1990s. We had the Space Exploration Initiative, and it got underway. And then a new administration came in, and it got canceled after billions of dollars had been spent. Then we go forward to the early 2000s. We had the Vision for Space Exploration, which was a return to the moon and then on to Mars. And then a new administration came in and it got canceled after billions of dollars were spent. And then we were floundering in the wilderness for a long time with a program called the Asteroid Redirect Mission, which basically lost all of our international partnerships. Like our international partners were done with us, because they did not want to do an asteroid redirect mission. And so the key is you have to have a program that can inspire the world, that can unite the international partners, that can compel them to increase their investments into the international partnership. And then once you have that program, then you have to have the continuity of purpose moving forward. So the key is from one administration to the next, and this is not just for this transition, but for every transition going forward, it needs to be understood that it is in the best interest of the new administration to continue the program. And I hope that, you know, if we do this right, 30 years from now, you know, my kids are going to be, you know, looking at astronauts routinely living and working on another world, the moon. Now, here's the thing. I was the first NASA administrator in history that was not alive when we had people living and working on the moon. That's right. A failure of our country. It's a failure of our international leadership. And of course that gives it takes all of our partnerships and it aligns them with our biggest competitor, in this case, China. And so we needed a moon program. We needed a Mars program. We put it together. We get all of our international partners back aligned with us, and now we can move forward in a meaningful and significant way. We look at what Japan is doing. They just increased their budget for human space exploration by like 20%. We look at what the European Space Agency has done. They've done the same thing. So when we have a good program with a great vision, we can actually get our partners to not only align with us, but increase their resources. And all of that, I think, is important for American leadership in space.
Let me ask you about program management, right? I mean, that's been key. You know, NASA for a while was criticized for, right, being too bulky, too bureaucratic, right? If you go back to the Apollo era, they were very young engineers working for the government who had technical expertise on par, if not superior, to what existed in industry to serve in that leadership role. And things were flat and moved really fast. What are some of the keys you've learned on how to manage big programs well, fast, deliver results, and actually maybe even save money in the process?
Yeah. So this is the fundamental flaw with the government owned and operated model. If you look at all of the established requirements for, you know, building a human system, for example, those requirements would require us to build a 7-story landing system with so much redundancy that you'll never be able to afford to build the human landing system. So there's a lot of regulation and a lot of policy that has been built over time that fundamentally makes it more challenging for the United States of America to go to the moon. However, there's commercial partners that can go to the moon, and they can go to the moon for their own purposes. The question is, and we're seeing that investment right now, the question is, can NASA adjust its processes and the way it thinks about safety? Can it adjust that in a meaningful way to be able to partner with those private companies as they are building their moon programs and as they are building their Mars programs? So the private sector here, I think, really is the innovator. The private sector of today is similar to the NASA of the 1960s. So I think, you know, the more we can do the public-private partnerships and encourage the private sector, the better.
Let me ask, Jim, about the fundamental approach we need with cooperation, right? I mean, you talk about the importance of international partners. You would talk about the importance of China as well. Obviously, it is a strategic competitor that does have some malign intent. At the end of the day, it's also working very hard to become a first order space power and will be, right? Having gone to the far side of the moon and landed, for example. What's the right balance, right? At the height of the Cold War, we still found ways to work with the Soviet Union, even though they were sort of committed to our destruction at the end of the day, and we more than somewhat to theirs. What's the right approach to take that blends cooperation with discipline, principle?
Yeah. So I think there's two things to think about. Number one, NASA should be and could be used more effectively as a tool of diplomacy for the United States of America. I can tell you every international conference I went to, China was exceedingly interested in the Artemis program. They have had a strong desire to be part of the International Space Station. So the question is, what are the behaviors that we need to see in order to allow them to do those activities, to be a part of those activities? And so when we think about NASA as a tool of diplomacy, it is the best brand that the United States of America has. When I go to Europe, as the NASA administrator, I was more popular in Europe than I was in the United States. Same in Japan. NASA has this amazingly important brand for the United States. So as a tool of diplomacy, we could say, look, if we're going to get into some kind of trade negotiation with China, can we put on the table, you know, access to the International Space Station as trade bait to extract things that we think are good or in the interests of the United States? Maybe trade is one thing. You know, the other thing is what other tools do we have in the tool belt to compel good behavior? And can you extend it to other areas, like setting up an air defense identification zone over the Senkaku Islands, or launching direct ascent anti-satellite missiles, or claiming the South China Sea, or building islands in the South China Sea? So we look at all of these challenges that we have terrestrially, and we say, look, if you want to partner with us on certain things, we need to see a change in behavior. Now, is NASA going to be that tool that compels them on those big terrestrial issues? Probably not. But it should be part of the mix. It should be part of the negotiation, part of the trade. And that's where it is a strong tool of diplomacy. And I think when you think about trade specifically, there's lots of opportunity there. I would also say this is one of the reasons we created the Artemis Accords. The Artemis Accords is a tool of, it says, look, we're going to explore space transparently. We're going to go and we're going to make sure that we're registering our objects in space. We're going to make sure that we are mitigating debris, that we are sharing scientific data with the world, and that we're going to operate safely. We're going to establish on the surface of the moon safety zones so that we all operate on a due regard basis, which of course is a term that comes from aviation. We won't mess with you if you don't mess with us. That's how due regard works over international waters. All of those legal regimes should apply in space and on other, planetary bodies. So the Artemis Accords are a way to say, if you want to be with us in the Artemis program, which everybody does, if you want to be with us in the Artemis program, you have to adhere to these very basic principles. And oh, by the way, these principles are enshrined in the Outer Space Treaty signed by every spacefaring nation on the planet back in 1967, although some countries don't follow that treaty the way they should. So the question is, how do you compel people to behave properly, responsibly in space? And I think NASA is a tool. The Artemis program is a great tool to say, if you want to be with us on the Artemis program, we're good with that. But here's what we need to see from you in order to be with us.
Let me ask you one follow-up question. And Rick, I'll come to you in just a moment about the ACORN's strategic growth plan. But let me, Jim, get your sense on space was always a military domain. So I think that it's somewhat disingenuous to not say that, right? I mean, it was at the vanguard. The first thing to go through space was a V2 rocket.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we're also seeing both more militarization, but also then extreme commercial clutter to the point where it's getting very, very dangerous in LEO and will be getting more dangerous. How do we need to think about both of these things as we try to explore, but also use, be responsible stewards of this critical resource?
Yeah, Vago, it's a great question, great point. And Rick Nagel addressed this a little bit earlier when he was talking about all of these proliferating technologies that can fundamentally, damage the United States of America. For example, the way we communicate, right now I'm talking on a podcast. Every terrestrial wireless network is dependent on a timing signal from GPS. So if we lose GPS, there's no terrestrial wireless networks that work. That's true for the power grid as well. Power grid is dependent on a timing signal from GPS, and so is every banking transaction in the United States of America. So if you lose GPS, you lose banking, you lose the power grid, and you lose terrestrial wireless networks. That is an existential threat to the United States. Each one of those are areas of critical infrastructure. But then we think about how we communicate with over-the-horizon communications, DirecTV, Dish Network, XM Radio, internet broadband from space, which a lot of people in rural America have, and a lot of people in Oklahoma have internet broadband from space. The way we produce food, the way we produce energy, the way we predict weather, the way we understand climate, the way we do national security and disaster relief, all of these things are dependent on space in a way that most people on a day in and day out basis don't think about or understand. It is critically important that, number one, that the enemies of the United States know that if they make investments into technologies, whether it's jamming, spoofing, hacking, dazzling, direct ascent anti-satellite weapons, co-orbital anti-satellite weapons, whatever investments they make are in vain, because we are not going to give them an advantage by proliferating those capabilities. So I think that's number one. And that's what the Space Force is all about, which, I was a big champion of the Space Force, years ago, even when I was in the House of Representatives. Back then, we called it the Space Corps. We got it through the House with 344 bipartisan votes, which doesn't happen very often. And then it went to the Senate and it died until President Trump resurrected it. So there's that. But you also mentioned something else, which is the clutter from all of the commercial activities. For that, right now, all that is still right now in the domain of the Department of Defense through the Combined Space Operations Center, which is now operated by U.S. Space Command. We have to take all of the unclassified commercial data from the integrated space operations picture. We need to take all that data and we need to give it to a civilian agency. In this case, the president designated the Commerce Department in his Space Policy Directive 3. Then that civilian agency needs to partner with commercial and private companies to deliver the most integrated space picture possible. And there needs to be an agency that has the ability to compel maneuvers, which right now we don't have. So right now, the way it works is the DoD will say, hey, 2 days from now, there's a 1 in 10,000 chance that your satellite is going to collide with some other satellite. Well, how many people are going to burn 4 months worth of station keeping fuel to avoid a a collision. That's a lot of money. And when it's only one in 10,000 chance, which is the highest probability we can get. So we need to get more data, better data. The space fence is going to help with that. We need to take that data. We need to get it to a civilian agency. That civilian agency needs to be able to compel maneuver in space, just like the FAA does with air traffic. And if we do all of it right, space will be sustainable and it will be protected. Those are the two key elements. You hit both of them, Vago. It has to be sustainable and it has to be protected, because if it's not protected, it ultimately won't be sustainable. And the United States of America has to lead on these issues. And we are. Rick Nagel mentioned earlier that we're behind. We are. But as is true throughout history, sometimes we're late to the party, but we always get the job done. And I'm very hopeful in this case, it will all come together in a way where space is both sustainable and protected.
And it's going to be a good business opportunity for somebody to get up there and actually clean space at some point. And I know a lot of people are working on it. Rick, very briefly, let me get your sense. Where do you want to be in another 5 years, right? Every time you and I talk, you guys have a tendency of sort of hitting your marks in terms of growth. Where do you want to be in another 5 years, especially with Jim on the team?
Well, first of all, we want to continue to add more talent like Jim to the team. And you can tell just by the depth and breadth that he's able to cover quickly. He's going to be a tremendous asset to us at Acorn and on our portfolio companies, and allows him to continue his mission of supporting the space industry and certainly the United States of America along with that. For us, it's more of the same. I think there's still, a lot of great companies that we depend on here in the United States for innovation that will help lead the way with respect to tackling a lot of the challenges we've addressed on this podcast here with you, Vago. Those companies need great partners. So for us, it's more capital, it's more partnerships and more opportunities as we diversify our portfolio in ways that help align with U.S. national security interests.
Guys, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Jim, Fairwinds Following Seas on the new assignment. Look forward to staying in touch. Rick, great call. Congratulations to you as well.
Thanks, Vago. Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.